Well, good morning, everyone. Usually when I come here, I have a guitar or something in my hand, and I may share a bit, I may share a song a bit later this morning. I don't have a Mother's Day message this morning, so if you came expecting that, I'm sorry about that. I'm going to talk about some other things. In fact, I'm going to talk about restlessness. And I was thinking about that, and maybe that is a Mother's Day message, because I'm my dear wife, I know when our children were young especially, it just often didn't get enough rest. So I guess she was restless minus rest. So if you can make that stretch, maybe this is a Mother's Day service after all. I drove down yesterday from Pennsylvania, and I actually went to a high school reunion last evening from 35 years ago, and these were all people I haven't seen anyone from that group since I left high school 35 years ago. It's astonishing because all these people that used to be my age, now they're bald and gray and stuff, and I'm like, what happened here? So that's what happens when life goes on. This morning, I'm going to tell a story and look at Scripture and draw some lessons from that about this whole thing of maybe God speaks to us through our restlessness sometimes. So any good story starts out with, once upon a time. There was a king, and the king ruled a great kingdom all the way from Africa up to what is now the country of Iraq. We don't know how he got to be king. We think he probably got to be king because his daddy was king. Sometimes that works out, sometimes not so much. The king's name is kind of hard to pronounce, so let's just call him Jack, King Jack. After a couple of years, he decided to celebrate his kingliness. And so he invited all the governors and princes and noble people and mayors and everybody, about 150 people. And we think that this party went on and on and on, a week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, a month and a half, 2 months, until 6 months went by. And these 150 noble people and princes and mayors were still partying to celebrate the king's kingliness. We don't know who was building roads so people could go back and forth to work and markets. We don't know who was building universities so people could study science and medicine and engineering and math. We don't know who was negotiating treaties so that there could be trade between other countries and the markets could flourish. We don't know who was doing the important work that governments are supposed to do while these 150 people were celebrating the king's kingliness with this grand party. At the end of 6 months, the king wanted to top all of this off. So he said, let's have a whole week, a final blast, go-out week, and I'll bring out all my wine. And there'll be two rules to drinking the king's wine. And the first rule is that you could drink any kind of the wine that you wanted. And the second rule was that you could drink as much wine as you wanted. A whole week of this, 150 guys in a place drinking. And at the end of the week, the king was thinking, what can we do to top all of this off? So he thought, I've got an idea. My wife, she's beautiful. I'll bring her out here and display her lovely self to all these men. What a great idea. Of course, all the drunk guys thought that was a great idea too, I'm sure. So the king summoned his wife. And she said, no, she's not going to do that. Now, I want to point something out here. You've got a king, and you've got 150 noble people and princes and whatever, and the only person in the room who had any common sense was the woman. Maybe there's a lesson there, guys. But the king was upset because this could bring chaos. Because what if other wives find out that they can say no to their husbands when they ask them to do something really, really dumb and refuse and common sense prevails. I mean, what happens if you'd have common sense breaking out all over the country? You can't be having that. So he called altogether his wisest people. You know, when you have a small problem, you can think about it and you can solve it yourself. When you have an average-sized problem, you might ask a few people for advice. But when you have your really big problem, you consult the smartest, wisest people that you can bring around to come up with a great idea to solve your big problem, right? And that's what the king did. He had this huge problem of common sense maybe breaking out all over the country. And so the wisest people in the room, the leftover drunk guys, said, well, fire her. She ought to be fired. So that's what he did. He fired the queen. And he sent out an order that all across the country, wives needed to obey their husbands. So they solved their problem. But then the king had another problem that occurred to him a couple of days later when he woke up alone. He said, I don't have a wife. I don't have a queen. And so, again, remember what you got to do when you have your biggest problems? You bring all the wisest people together to solve your biggest problem. We still don't know who was building roads, who was making treaties with other countries, who was building universities so there could be advances in medicine and math and science and the society could progress forward. They decided that to solve the king's problem of not having a wife, they would take applications to be queen. And they would gather all the most beautiful women from the kingdom that they could gather and bring them all together. And parents, I'm sorry, but this story is kind of graphic. So the king could have, let's say, a test drive with each of the beautiful women. And so that's, and doesn't this sound like it's something that a bunch of 150 bunch of drunk guys would come up with? So they brought together a whole bunch of beautiful women. The king went on his test drive every night until he found the one that was the most beautiful and the one that was most pleasing to him. Now, in this country, a couple of generations earlier, there had been brought a whole group of immigrants. And there were immigrants that were about the same color and everything, but they were a different race, and they sort of blended in with society. You couldn't just look at them and tell that they were a different race. And the young lady who pleased the king the most was from this immigrant group that came through. The king didn't know this. And the king really liked the young lady, and they got along well, and things were going fine. But this young girl had an uncle. She was an orphan child, and her uncle also had a hard name to pronounce, so we'll just call him Uncle Mick. And Uncle Mick was really concerned about this niece of his, so he'd come every day to the palace to sit by the by the area there, just to make sure that there was no disruptions and things were going okay. And one day, King Jack sent some deputies out to just check on things, and there were orders that everybody needs to bow down a certain way to the king and all of that. And Uncle Mick had just had it up to here with stuff. And so these deputies walked by, and he forgot conveniently to bow down. And it really infuriated these deputies. And so they went back to the king, and they said, look, you have a problem in your kingdom. There's a whole bunch of immigrants. They don't participate in our ways. They keep to themselves. They're not like us, and they disrespect you as a king. So we'd like you as a king to have them all killed. The king said, okay. When I read this story, sometimes I think the king might have had another name besides Jack, but let's let that go for now. So King Jack sent out an order that all these immigrant people were going to be killed. And by the way, by now you might have figured out that I'm talking about Esther in the Old Testament. It's all there. Read it this afternoon, and all this stuff is in there. And Esther was the queen, and she heard about this order that was given to all across the kingdom that all of her country people and her fellow Jewish people were to be killed about a year later. They were going to be slaughtered, and all of their household goods, their property, their houses, everything was to be divided up among their neighbors. And Uncle Mick challenged Esther to think about this. Now, I don't think Esther was very old. She probably was a young girl, probably was still a teenager, maybe 18, 19, 20 years old. And Uncle Mick talked with Esther about this immense challenge that her people were facing. And something must have been stirring in Esther. Even as a young girl who was all of a sudden brought out of a quiet life into the palace to be the king, the queen to King Jack. But something must have been stirring in her, because when she had a conversation with Uncle Mick, she heard the plea in Uncle Mick's voice to maybe you can do something about this. And so she agreed to listen and to try to make some effort to deal with this. And the point where I'm going with this story is the challenge that Uncle Mick, or Mordecai, as the book of Esther describes. In verse 12 of chapter 4, Mordecai sent back this answer: "Don't think that just because you're in the king's house that you alone will escape. Don't think that that's going to protect you. Maybe it will, but if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will come from somewhere else. But you and your father's family will perish." Something about the justice that God would mete out at some point for her unwillingness to respond to this need. And then Uncle Mick said this, and I think this reaches each one of us. He said, "And who knows, but that maybe you have come to this place for such a time as this." Who knows, but that maybe you were put here in this place for such a time as this. I grew up in this community. Or sometimes I tell people that what growing up I did in South Carolina. And like many of the people in my youth group, I married and moved away and raised a family. And I was probably one of the first generation of people to sort of grow up here and then make choices that took me far away. Choices about where to live and careers, who to marry, and sometimes what belief system would guide my life. And lots of others did that too from my generation. If you look around, I'll bet that's still going on. People growing up here and making choices about who to marry, where to live, and what careers to have, and sometimes what belief system will guide their life. And I remember as a teenager being restless. And I remember that a lot of us were restless when I was in the youth group. Restlessness is a normal thing for youth and young adults. You're trying to figure out what's inside of you and how that fits in with what's around you. And that's hard to do that. And 35 years ago, there were a lot of restrictions and expectations on us. Those of you that are younger, ask your parents about that sometimes. And sometimes those restrictions and expectations felt a lot like fences. Like fences were there between me and what I want. And some of us looked beyond those fences. And there were probably those who wanted to get away, and so fences get pushed. You know about that. And the restrictions at that time were about TV and clothes and hairstyle and neckties and going to movies and whatever. But if you're not thoughtful about it, when you push a fence, sometimes you just trade one barnyard for another barnyard. But maybe something else is going on. And when something inside of you wakes up you're often drawn towards something that seems higher and more compelling. And you know, there's a difference between leaving to get away from something and going toward something, starting a journey that takes you towards something. There's a huge difference. Bill Hybels is the pastor at the Willow Creek Community Church near Chicago, and I was privileged to hear him speak a few weeks ago. He talks about an inner restlessness that draws people toward what might be their calling. And Hybels calls this a holy discontent. A holy discontent. It happens to people when something inside feels called to do something more profound and more compelling than the current opportunities provide. You might learn about a need, a compelling urgency somewhere where lives are at stake, and you wonder if something should be done. Someone said that hope is hearing the music of heaven. Hearing the music of heaven. But that faith is dancing to it in the present. Think about that. Hope is hearing the music of heaven, but faith is dancing to it in the present. And you may be called to dance to heaven's music now, to live and make important choices that line up with your gifts and your skills and your passions, with profound opportunities to be salt and light in new and profound ways, areas of great need. Paul makes a comment in the book of Romans that faith comes by hearing the word. And I used to interpret that as faith comes when you hear more sermons, maybe like this. I'm not sure that that's correct. And so I used to sometimes think that faith fills in the gap between what I know and what I'm supposed to believe. That's whatever gap that's there is what faith is. And I suppose there were people at the time when it was widely believed that the earth was flat and rumors started happening that the world was really round, like a ball, that some people may have believed that, but they didn't see the evidence, and so maybe faith is sort of the piece that fills in the gap between what you see around you of a flat earth and what scientists are telling you about a round earth. You know that some people are saying the world's going to end in, what, a week and a half? We're down to a week and a half, May the 21st. They claim that there's evidence in the Bible that points to this or that or some numbers or whatever. And I heard a story on the way down here of a couple that was really into this, and they had planned it so that their finances would be completely spent down by May the 21st. Because what's the point of that? And I guess you could go out and run up credit card debt too, because, you know, when the June bill comes, you won't be here anyway, right? Well, you know, that takes something that some people would call faith between what you really understand to be true and what's sort of projected out there. I'm not sure at all that that's what faith is. I think maybe faith is embracing a concept that's bigger than I am and actually doing something about it. For example, I have faith that God can take my brokenness and your brokenness and your humanity, whatever is useless about you, I believe that God can take that and use that in profound ways to build his kingdom. I believe that. Now, I don't have a lot of proof that is true, but that's sort of like hearing the music of heaven and being willing to dance to it now, to live by that profound truth now. And perhaps that is more what faith is. Faith really is action based on a profound transcending truth. It's an action that's based on truth that resonates with your spirit. And that's why the Apostle James writes that faith without works is dead. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist, it's just dead, like a tomato stalk in September, October after the first frost. It still exists, but it's dead and it's useless. Faith without works is dead. And Hebrews 11 is full of people, examples of people who understood that faith is the substance of the things you hope for and look for, the music from heaven that you can dance to and live with now. Hebrews 11 is just a catalog list of people who organize their lives around God's call to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly with Him. And like Esther, I think we're called to do something. Let's look at a couple of things that we might be called to do. Consider that about half of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. About half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. That's two real dollars. And they live in places where, two of those in a day. They live in places where, you know, it doesn't just cost 5 cents to buy a gallon of milk and 3 cents to buy a loaf of bread. And rent isn't $3 a month either in these places. Cost of living is high. They just cannot afford those kinds of things. $2 a day is not enough to live decently anywhere in the world. But about half of our neighbors around the world do that. I don't like to think of myself as rich. You ask me if I'm rich, and my first thought is, nah, I'm not rich. But the fact is, I live in a house that doesn't have a dirt floor. We have two cars. I have more than two sets of clothes to wear. I go to the refrigerator, and there's more than two choices of foods to eat in our refrigerator and pantry. I have more than two pairs of shoes, and I have a computer. In fact, two of them. And I have a stove, a refrigerator, and a microwave. And having those things puts me in the top 5% of the wealthiest people in the world. Our global brothers and sisters, 95% of them don't have those things. Most of you are there too. And when we understand that, we start to look around and wonder if God sees us. Does God see us as the richest 5% of the people in the world? I'll let you answer that question. I think you know the answer to that. God cares about things like that. And in fact, much of the Bible is devoted to the responsibility that the rich have to the poor. The rich, by the definition that perhaps God sees and uses, that's us. And a friend of mine who is also rich like me and you talked about seeing pictures and images of suffering people on television. And you've seen the pictures, the kids with flies walking across their face and the earthquake victims in Haiti and other places and kids growing up in the cities without parents who call them precious. And my friend said he almost asked God, said, God, why don't you do something about this? And he didn't, because he paused enough to wonder if maybe God would ask him the same question. Why don't you do something about this? The words that challenge Esther challenge us. Maybe you were called to such a time as this. We were all startled a few days ago when the September 11, 2001 tragedy was brought back to mind again, and we're reminded of those terrible pictures of planes flying into buildings and the tragic loss of life that happened that day. Almost 3,000 people, men, women, children, moms and dads who got up that morning to go to work or to take a trip, just being responsible with their lives, and without warning, their lives were just snatched away. And like me, you probably had dozens of conversations with friends about the meaning and the impact of that day. A friend of mine named Linda Peachy helped edit a book called Where Was God on September 11 that seeks to draw some meaning from all of that chaos. But I sometimes wonder what God saw in that day. Pause a moment and think about that. Now, his heart must have been broken by the brutality and the hatred and the senselessness of it all. 3,000 people created in his image who were just killed. But I wonder if God noticed something else that day. And I wonder if God noticed what happened on September 10, the day before, and September 12 and 13, and every day since then. Because every day about 30,000 people, mostly children, die from measles and hunger and other easily preventable diseases. The things they die of are things that you and I, the rich, would just go to the refrigerator or the local pharmacy and take care of with little worry. 30,000 people, that's more than 10 times as many as died on September 11 in our country. Their deaths are not dramatic. CNN doesn't cover them. But their families and their loved ones mourn just as much. What does God see when God looks down? And trust me, it's a lot easier to have conversations with friends about September 11 than September 10 and this other tragedy that goes on. Some people look at those deaths as being one way of nature sort of purging the world to keep overpopulation from happening. That's really cold. That's really cold. And I have to say no. God loves the people, probably several thousand who have died just since we've been together here this morning. God loves them as much as he loves you and as he loves me. And God has no intention that any of them should perish. And I look at me. I'm in the top 5%, and I think maybe I was called to such a time as this. A holy discontent that takes you toward something. Frederick Buechner is a highly respected theologian and author, and he says that the place where God calls you is the place where your heart's deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. The place where God calls you is the place where your heart's deep gladness and where the world's deep hunger meet. Back 35 years ago, when I was around, there were a lot of people who were moving into the area and starting businesses. And I look around and I see probably a dozen or two businesses around the area, and the Mennonites in this community, many of them have become well-established and highly respected as business people in the community. You're blessed with hard workers and smart, ambitious leaders. And as the next generation comes along, it's an easy choice for children to pick up in the business and follow the path set by their parents. And if that's someone's calling, then God bless you. May you find all the joy and fulfillment of a faithful life. But I'm sure there are people in this community, perhaps in this church, who feel a tension between parents' expectations and perhaps a restlessness in your heart for deep and meaningful work in God's kingdom. And sometimes it's hard to resist the pressure to take the easier road, even if there is a holy discontent, an inner urge to take your gifts and your skills and passions and use them in devoted service in ways that match up with what you are called to do. I would just say, let your faith be watered by hearing and by learning and absorbing as much as you can to cultivate your spirit as you're drawn toward greater service. And if you hear that music of heaven, then start dancing now, because maybe you were called, like Esther, to such a time as this. Well, people don't choose that path because it's easy, and often it's the more difficult choice that makes things go in a very very, very difficult. And sometimes we lose courage. It's okay. It didn't go smoothly for Esther. And you have to wonder if she lost courage. Look at the story and see what happened. She decided to go in to see the king and took great risk to herself, because in those days, the king was the king and everybody else was way down here. Even the queen was way down here. And if the king didn't want to see you, all he'd have to do was just send a signal and you'd be taken out. And the punishment for such audacity to go in and see the king when you weren't invited or expected, the punishment was death. It didn't happen a lot, but it was always a possibility, even to a queen. You saw what happened to Vashti, her predecessor, when all she did was display some common sense. So she approached the king with this great burden, this great calling, this great mission to save her people. And the king said, "Come in, Esther. What do you want? It's good to see you. I will give you anything you want, even up to half of the kingdom." What a golden opportunity to say, "Yes, I'm here." How about, "King, if we arrange to have my people saved, because I'm a Jew like these other people, it's not a big deal. We're not doing much harm. Just do a decree. It's not even half your kingdom, not even 10% of your kingdom. Just do that. Would you please do that?" She didn't say that. You know what she said? She said, "Well, Let's have lunch." Okay. The king said, "Fine, let's have lunch." And so they had lunch, and the king asked again, "Esther, it's good to see you. Something is on your mind and on your heart. Tell me what you want, and I'll give it to you, even up to half the kingdom." And this poor teenage girl with this great mission on her shoulders, you know what she said? She said, "Well, let's have lunch again." Sometimes it's hard to make these requests. Now, the story goes on, and while this delay was happening, God was doing some powerful things behind the scene to move the king to grant her wish in a providential kind of way. But you have to wonder if Esther lost courage. You can't blame her. We all understand that, and it helps us to appreciate the anguish that must have been in her mind. But the story ends well for Esther, and this story became a story of deliverance for the Jewish people, and it's celebrated even today. It's known as the Feast or the Celebration of Purim. And the book of Esther really is a background of the Jewish holiday of Purim, just like our own Christmas story background is often found in Luke 2 as a celebration of Christ's birth. So pay attention to restlessness and consider whether it's a holy discontent. And consider your own heart's deep gladness and whether you understand and appreciate the depth of the world's need. And as you think of how you might organize your life to respond, consider if you, like Esther, were called to such a time as this. I occasionally write a song to go with a sermon, and I was driving down yesterday, and a song happened, so I'm going to share it with you now. So it's one of the freshest homemade songs you've ever heard in your life. How's that? And by the way, I have some CDs. I did some CDs a couple of years ago, and I have some out there. I have plenty of them, and I've been blessed. They're all paid for. So if you would like to have a CD, please feel free to take one. Normally I ask about $10 for one, but if you'd like to take one and don't have the money, that's fine. Or if you'd like to pay later, or if you'd rather, actually, I'll tell you what I would really prefer. Take a CD if you'd like it, and sometime down the road, make a donation to some organization that you care about, or go buy a book. Or read a book that you've been thinking about reading that you think may have a profound impact on your life. And if you do that, that'll be good enough for me. I'll share a song and then we'll go on. Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a time as this to live out what you are for? With a love so rich and a grace so pure to lead you through the door. Was there ever a time as this, when there was so much at stake, to give your gifts, your salt and light, to the difference you can make? And it's easy to turn the other way and go on down the road, but the easy way just leaves you empty. Because maybe you were called, maybe you were called to such a time as this. Was there ever a time as this to live out what you are for? With a love so rich and a grace so pure to lead you through the door. And it's easy to turn the other way and go on down the road, but the easy way just leaves you empty. Because maybe you were called, maybe you were called, maybe you were called to such a time.